Well, this morning we're going to take a journey together. We're going to go back into antiquity and learn what crucifixion was all about. I do want to tell you ahead of time that what we're going to be talking about is kind of graphic, and it is disturbing. And so I want to give you permission ahead of time if some of what we discussed this morning is a little more than you feel comfortable with. Feel free to just walk out for a little bit. I don't like to give this lecture. I don't give it often, but it does kind of fit in with resurrection, which we'll talk about next week. So we are going to be talking about crucifixion and what it was like. So grab my hand and let's go into the past. So where does crucifixion, where did it come from? We're not quite certain. But Cicero, he was one of the major figures of the Roman Empire in the first century before Christ. And he, in fact, at times he was the most powerful man in Rome. And he talks about crucifixion being, and I quote, "that most cruel and disgusting penalty, the worst extremes of tortures." And then at another occasion, he talks about the terror of the cross. On another occasion, he talks how Romans should never have to fear being crucified. They should never be a witness to a crucifixion. They could be exempt from even witnessing one. In fact, Cicero said that a Roman should never, ever have to hear the word crucifixion. The origin of crucifixion is uncertain. We know the Persians were doing it in the 5th century before Christ. Alexander the Great at one point performed 2,000 crucifixions at one time in the 4th century BC. And you've heard of Spartacus, not the U.S. senator, but the real one. And Spartacus had been a gladiator, and he knew some other gladiators, and they got together, and thousands of them, they revolted against the Romans in the 1st century BC. And as they were actually defeating a lot of the Roman legions, and they gained thousands and thousands of more, and then farmers took up their weapons and made swords, and they joined Spartacus's army, and they were fighting the Romans, and they continued to defeat them, and the Romans are like, what are we going to do? And Spartacus at one point says, hey, let's go north, let's get out of here, let's just get to freedom. Which would have been the right thing for him to do. But his army said, no, we're going to go into Rome, and we're going to let's go ahead and just take Rome and just throw these guys out. And Spartacus said no, and then he got afraid that they were going to kill him, so he went along with it, and they ended up fighting the Romans. And then there was a Roman general who was also one of the most powerful people in Rome, and his name was Crassus. And Crassus's army went against Spartacus, and they went back and forth, and finally Crassus built a wall, which Plutarch said was 40 miles long, in order to hem in Spartacus and his army. Well, that's probably an exaggeration, 40 miles, but it was still a massively long wall, and Crassus ended up defeating Spartacus, and then crucified 6,000 of his soldiers along the Appian Way. What did a crucifixion look like? Well, there were what were called the pre-crucifixion tortures. We see it about Jesus with scourging, but there were other tortures that would often accompany crucifixion in that pre-crucifixion torture. And these sorts of things are mentioned in the ancient literature. So, for example, we have Socrates who mentions it, Plato, Herodotus, Josephus, Dionysius, Livy, and Philo. And they mention how in pre-crucifixion torture, they would use whips, they would burn with fire and hot irons, and they would often mutilate the people they were going to crucify. Lucian, who wrote in the 2nd century, in about the middle of the 2nd century, there's very little written about how to write history, but Lucian wrote a book called, the title was How to Write History. And in that book, he mentions how a man, he saw a man who had been whipped, his eyes put out, and his tongue cut off before being crucified. Maybe we've talked about this before, how some of Jesus' apostles had disciples of their own later on. The apostle John, the son of Zebedee, had a disciple named Polycarp. And Polycarp was later on martyred. He was burned at the stake. And there's a piece of literature that remains called The Martyrdom of Polycarp. It talks about what happened. But in that piece of literature, it talks about some of the pre-crucifixion tortures, one being scourging. And it says that when a person was scourged by the Romans, they were so torn by whips that their veins and arteries became visible. That's in the Martyrdom of Polycarp. Josephus speaks of a man who was whipped until his bones were seen. And then you've got, he says that men were whipped on one occasion until their intestines were exposed. And then Philo, in the first century, he's writing right around the time that Jesus was alive. He says that he speaks of Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, who would be, they would be tortured. They would be brought out into the arena at 6 a.m., and they would be tortured for 3 hours. Now, he's not clear whether they, the individuals would be tortured for 3 hours or that they'd be tortured and then bring some more in and so forth. But you start at 6, torture these Jews until 9, and then they'd be dragged out of the arena and crucified outside the city. So what would that kind of torture do to an individual? Dr. Fred Zugabe is a forensic pathologist. He worked for Columbia University for a while. And he did a lot of experiments on live people. Now, these were, he wouldn't actually nail or scourge them, but he wanted to see, get an idea of some of the effects when you tortured someone like this. And so what he did was he took student volunteers, and he would form like a cross, but instead of nails, of course, he'd use straps, and these were volunteers, and he'd have the subjects hooked up so that he could take their vitals and see what's going on. And he says it wouldn't take long at all, and these volunteers would be exhausted, shivering, severe sweating, frequent seizures, and intense thirst would happen while they were in that position. And that's without being tortured first. Then he talks about the crown of thorns. What would that have been like? And he says, given the complex distribution of nerves in the head, the crown of thorns would have produced the kind of pain felt when nerves are touched by a dentist drill. That's the pre-crucifixion tortures. What about the crucifixion itself? What did a cross look like? Well, how many of you have had Jehovah's Witnesses come to your door? Most of us have. And I know some of you probably just slammed the door shut and said, I already got my church, right? I hope you don't do that. Because you know what? We're supposed to be sharing our faith with others. And here are some people who are interested in religious matters, right? And they're very sincere, but they're sincerely wrong. And we look for opportunities to share our faith with others, and they show up at our door. So why not take advantage of it, right? So be prepared. If you want to be prepared to talk to Jehovah's Witnesses, go to my website. Here's my website, risenjesus.com. Risenjesus.com. You can go to my website and you go to resources, and there's a free ebook there that I wrote years ago, and the title is Behold, I Stand at the Door and Knock. What to say to Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses when they knock on your door. The alternate title would have been Knock, Knock, Who's There? And in there, it's just a short little book. You can download it for free and see how to answer Mormons and see how to answer Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, they will talk about how, so what do you think Jesus' cross would look like? Well, you know, was this thing had a cross beam? No, no, they'll say, that's not true. Because the Greek word that's used there, they will say, is zoulon, and that just means a stake. Well, they don't know Greek. I have fun with them when they come to the door. I invite them in. So how much Greek do you have? Well, we've never taken Greek. Okay, well, I've had 5 years of graduate level Greek. I read the Greek New Testament virtually every day. I've done so for over 20 years. And look, that Greek word zoulon there just means something wooden. And then I'll take them to a couple of texts in the New Testament. For example, in Mark 14:48, it talks about how at Jesus' arrest, the crowds came with clubs and swords. And the word clubs is zoulon. And then when Paul and Silas are thrown into prison in Acts 16:24. Their feet are placed in stocks. Zoulon, same Greek word there. Zoulon does not mean a stake. It just refers to something that's wooden. It could be any shape. It could be in any form for any purpose. It just means it's wooden. That's all it means. In Revelation 22:2, it talks about the tree of life. Zoulon. So all that's telling us is not that Jesus' cross was just a stake. It means it was made of wood. That's all it means. Wood, not aluminum. In the first and second century, crosses were shaped, we have in what's called the letter of Barnabas and Lucian, and Artemidorus talks about how crosses were shaped as the letter tau, which would be our letter T. So being a crossbeam. Gemstones from the 2nd and 3rd century have been discovered, and they depict Christ being crucified on a T-shaped cross. You have graffiti dated to the 3rd century, which shows a cross beam. Now, the footrest and a seat in which to sit, and which you see depicted often in medieval paintings, were doubtless not there. There would be no reason for that. Obviously, with the pre-crucifixion torture and the stuff that they did with crucifixion, the Romans are wanting you to be in the greatest amount of agony. They are not going to provide a footrest or a seat in order for you to rest. Not interested in your comfort. Well, to put you on the cross, it's usually through nailing. In 1968, in Jerusalem, they found the skeletal remains of a crucified victim, and the bone was still lodged in this person's ankle bone. And they think that what happened was when they nailed this guy, whose name was Yehohanan, when they nailed his ankle to the cross, and in this case, they probably had it where they put the feet, straddled the legs to the cross, bent the knees up, and then nailed through your ankle directly into the side of the cross is probably how they did it. And they think that probably what happened is that the nail hit a knot in the wood and kind of turned in into like a hook, and they found it very difficult to get out, and so they just left it in there. And since then, they have found several more nails that were used in crucifixions. Many ancient sources, I counted 16 when I looked for it. There were 16 ancient sources that mentioned nails used in the process of crucifixion. I only found one source that mentioned binding a person to the cross with ropes, and that was a guy named Xenophon in the 4th century BC, and he talked about how this was a practice in Alexandria, Egypt. So it wouldn't appear that a person was bound to the cross with ropes, at least how Rome did it. Perhaps they did it to support, give further support to the nail, but probably not. And then you've got Josephus. When he's describing these things, Josephus says that the soldiers, out of rage and hatred, they bore the prisoners. They nailed those they caught in different postures to the crosses by way of jest, and their number was so great, about 500 a day, that there was not enough room for the crosses and not enough room for the bodies. Now, he's referring to the fall of Jerusalem, a war that took place in the late 60s, and so they were crucifying about 500 a day at that point of Jews that the Romans had caught. Crucifixion was an unspeakably cruel process. You've got there's the sensory motor median nerve. If you take your finger, if you take your thumb and you kind of put it here and you move it around, you'll feel a little tingling like that funny bone. Okay, so what happens is this is probably where the nail went, because studies they've done on cadavers through the palm, and medieval paintings show through the palm, but studies there would show that the weight of the body could not be supported by the bones in the hand, and it would just tear through. So they probably put the nail through the wrist. Now you say, well, wait a minute, doesn't the Gospel of John talk about nails being in the hands? Thomas asked to see the nail print in Jesus' hands. It does say that. So is that a problem? Well, it's not, because the Greek word for hands is hair, like hair. It's not spelled the same way, but it's hair. And that can mean anywhere from the upper arm all the way down to the fingertips. So they didn't have a word like we have hand that separates it from the rest of the arm. So it could have been anywhere on the arm. In fact, there's one account that talks about being double nailed in the hand, which would mean, you know, double nailed anywhere in the arm. So it was here. So when they put the nail into that part of the wrist, imagine every time you're on the cross, just a little bit of movement would hit that, rub up against that nerve, and it would be just like a bolt of pain, like you hitting your funny bone. The word excruciating derives from the Latin out of the cross, or from the cross. You'd have outstretched arms on the cross. Many times the shoulders would become dislocated. You would have severe muscle cramps due to dehydration. And then you would also have, while on the cross, depending on the time of the year, but if it were during the warmer months, you would have annoying insects as well. You would have victims. They were pretty active while on the cross. The impression that we get when we see medieval paintings is that Jesus is just kind of sitting on his seat on the cross and just kind of like he's waiting to die. But that's not at all what it would have been like. There's no seat, and so what happens is you have your feet nailed to the cross, and usually your arms would be kind of like at this angle, not at this angle, but at this angle. And what you would do is you would, you'd have the pain in your feet, so you want to take the weight off your feet, and so you would slouch down. And but in that position, it was very difficult to exhale, and your muscles that you would use for exhaling are not as strong as the muscles for inhaling. So it would be very difficult to exhale when you're in that down position. And so you have carbon dioxide buildup, which could cause spasms if you don't get rid of it. And so you push up on your pierced feet and you pull on your wrist that had been nailed. And of course, that's rubbing up against that sensory motor median nerve. And you exhale and then you go down and it's very shallow breathing. So that's why they would break a victim's legs. They can't push up anymore, and the person dies from too much carbon dioxide. A very agonizing death. Seneca, in the first century, he was considered to be one of the brightest, perhaps the brightest Roman mind. He was a philosopher and a lawyer. And he talked about what crucified victims looked like. He says they were, and imagine what it would look like after all that torture and then being on the cross. He refers to crucified victims, describes them as battered and ineffective carcasses, maimed, misshapen, deformed, nailed, and drawing the breath of life amid long, drawn-out agony. Sometimes brutal treatment was given to people while on the cross. Nero, a very wicked Roman emperor in the 60s, 50s and 60s, he crucified, Tacitus tells us how he crucified people and in his gardens, and then at night he would light them up on fire in order to provide torches for his garden. In the last quarter of the first century, a Roman writer named Martial spoke of a real criminal who was brought into a public performance of a theatrical performance, and who the actor in this performance was condemned to death. And so what happened is they substitute at the last moment the actor, they substitute the criminal, and they crucify him alive while on stage. And then they took a bear and set the bear on the person who tore him apart and just mauled him alive while on stage in front of everyone. Josephus reports a particularly brutal treatment, and I quote him. He says, "They were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces and were crucified while they were still alive and breathed. They also strangled those women and their sons whom they had circumcised as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon the crosses." So you imagine you're tortured and then you're crucified, and then they bring your wife and kids out and then they kill them before you and then take your infant son that they had just killed and put him around your neck while you're on the cross. They would do that because they wanted you to feel the emotional pain of seeing your family killed and also knowing that you have no posterity. You are being cut off forever. And then there was the matter of dishonor. We don't really understand this so much today because we don't live in an honor-shame culture. But they did in the first century, and they still do in the Middle East today, Israel and in Arab countries, an honor and shame culture. So humiliation was something that was very big back then. The crucified were typically executed naked, so you didn't have a piece of cloth over you like they show Jesus in the movies and in paintings. He was probably naked when he was crucified. And sometimes, in order to dishonor you even more, they would build, they would crucify you up high. So the higher you were, the higher, taller your cross was, the more dishonored they wanted to bring to you. If you remember in the book of Esther, you have Haman who builds gallows 75 feet tall for Mordecai and was going to hang him from that. And then Haman himself ended up getting hung from it. You would mock the victim while on the cross. We have Iamblichus in the first century BC, and he talks about how there was a king named Janaeus, and he brought out some of his enemies and crucified them, and then he prepared and threw a banquet in front of their crosses, feasted and ate while flute players and musicians were playing and dancing, and they would mock the victims. And while they're partying before their crosses, their victims are hanging in pain. You were usually denied a proper burial if you were crucified. And this was bad whether you were a Gentile or a Jew. If you were a Gentile, or let's say a Greek, the belief was that you should have a proper burial. If you did not get a proper burial, then your spirit could not rest. It would just wander around aimlessly with no place to rest for all eternity. And so a proper burial was extremely important to you if you were a Gentile. If you were a Jew, then you look at Deuteronomy 21:23, and it says, "Cursed is the man who is hung on a tree." So you were cursed by God, considered to be cursed by God, if you were crucified. So you didn't want to be crucified if you were a Jew, because you were cursed by God. And if you were a Gentile, you were denied a proper burial. And so not only your pain, your agony wouldn't stop at the cross. It would continue throughout all of eternity as your spirit wandered around with no place to rest. Again, we don't have that today. We don't have those kind of beliefs today. But for those in antiquity, this was a very serious part of the punishment. And so people were denied a proper burial. Typically speaking, they would take your corpse, they'd throw it into a pit of where other criminals had been buried, and then just throw a little bit of dirt over it, and then wait for the next criminals. And of course, while your corpses are in there, it would be further devoured by insects, dogs, and birds. That cross, the corpse of the crucified, would become food for scavengers. Oh, by the way, so what about Jesus and the burial by Joseph? Some skeptics would say, just because the Roman practice was to give you a dishonorable burial, to throw you into a common pit, that the story of Jesus' burial by Joseph of Arimathea was later invented. It is not real. What they don't take into consideration, a couple of things. One is that Josephus, in his Jewish War, his book Jewish War, talks about just before the fall of Jerusalem, some mercenary soldiers that the Romans had hired came into Jerusalem. They killed a bunch of Jews, and it outraged the Jews because these mercenaries would not allow those whom they had killed to receive a proper burial. And Josephus reports that the Romans allowed the Jews prior to that time to remove the criminals from their crosses and give them a proper burial prior to sunset. And this is plausible because we know that the Romans, when they conquered someone, a people, they usually allowed them, in order to maintain some sort of peace, they allowed them to maintain a lot of their customs. So that we see this like with coins that were minted at that time in Palestine. So, for example, I have a coin that I picked up in Jerusalem when I was there 2 years ago. It's a Pilot coin. And Pontius Pilate minted coins while he was the prefect, the governor of Judea. There were 3 years that he minted coins, 29, 30, and 31. And when you see these coins, they don't have any kind of an image of a human or of an animal on it, because the Jews would not allow an image, especially of a person, any person. That's why they wouldn't allow, later on, they wouldn't allow images of Tiberius Caesar into Jerusalem, because they thought it would defile their city. So Pilate allowed them to keep that custom, and so he minted coins without Caesar's image on it for those years. So we see numerous people who had been crucified or executed in Jerusalem, and they were buried in their skeletal remains in what are called ossuaries. There are these bone boxes that are about 2 feet long, about a foot and a half wide, and about a foot and a half tall. And what they would do is they would bury someone in a tomb, come back a year later after their body had decomposed, grab the bones, put it in these ossuaries, and then give them a proper burial. They have found more than 1,000 ossuaries in Jerusalem. Not all of crucified people, executed people, but this just shows that the Romans would allow proper burials to occur in Jerusalem. So there's no reason to think that Jesus' body was thrown into a common pit at that time. Moreover, historians look for multiple independent sources. And even skeptical historians today, historians of Jesus, will acknowledge that the Gospel of John was written independently of the Gospel of Mark. And Mark and John both talk about the burial of Jesus by Joseph of Arimathea, on the who sat on the Sanhedrin. So you have multiple independent sources that talk about this proper burial of Jesus. So we have every reason to think that Jesus' body was not thrown into a pit. The corpses of the crucified did become food for scavengers. So it says you've got one author of the 3rd century. He talks about punished with limbs outstretched, the crucified are fastened and nailed to it in the most bitter torment, evil food for birds of prey and grim pickings for dogs. In the early 2nd century, Juvenal wrote, "The vulture hurries from dead cattle and dogs and crosses to bring flesh to her offspring. So what we have here is, in crucifixion, the person was put through some of the most horrendous tortures, then the most painful of deaths, in full public display, in nudity, was mocked while in intense pain, his posterity sometimes eliminated before his eyes, he was refused burial, and then his body was left for scavengers. It was the worst way to die in antiquity. So who was crucified? For whom was this kind of barbaric death reserved? Well, slaves for one, the worst of criminals, rebels. Roman citizens were generally exempt from it. Now, there are a few cases where a Roman emperor would order the crucifixion of, say, a Roman senator or another Roman, but it was very, very rare, and it wasn't supposed to happen. Slaves had little protection from crucifixion. So we read in Juvenal of a slave who informed his master that his master's sons were planning to betray his country to an enemy. After confirming the report, the master killed his own slaves, killed his own sons, then freed the slave as a savior of the country, and then turned around and crucified him for informing on his master. Cassius Dio in the second century talks about a slave who had abandoned his master because the master had plotted to kill the emperor Augustus. However, Augustus, after the slave saved Augustus's life, Augustus allowed the master of the slave, he allowed that master to crucify the slave for informing on his master. Cicero reports that of a woman who had one of her slaves crucified, but before she crucified him, she had the guy's tongue cut out. She didn't like this slave. Her husband did. She didn't like the slave, so she falsely accused the slave and then cut out his tongue so he couldn't speak to his own innocence. And then she had him crucified. Was Jesus crucified? How do we know if Jesus was crucified? Well, the Gospels do report it. Paul reports it. It's all in, through lots of literature in the New Testament. So we do have reason to think, because we have multiple independent reports. You say, well, wait a minute, it's all in the New Testament. Yes, but even skeptical scholars will acknowledge that even though we have one book that contains the New Testament and the Old Testament in our Bibles, these are 66 books and letters. And in the New Testament, they are written by no less than 9 authors in the New Testament alone. So we do have multiple independent sources that mentions Jesus' crucifixion. Some of those sources are quite early. Almost all of them are first century, of course, but some of them are really early. So, for example, you've got Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. He's writing within probably 25 years of the crucifixion. And then he has material that derives from oral tradition that goes back even earlier, and that's called kerygma. You have unsympathetic sources. So, for example, Josephus, the Jewish historian in the first century, mentions Jesus' crucifixion. You have Tacitus in the early second century who mentions it. You have Lucian in the middle of the second century who mentions Jesus' crucifixion as well. And then we have what are called, we could say, our embarrassing reports. Now, most readers of the Gospels and aren't going to see this, but when you go back to antiquity and you read the martyrdom accounts, like of Jewish martyrs and Christian martyrs, we find something that's really interesting. So, for example, if you ever read the book of 2 Maccabees, that belongs to the Jewish Apocrypha, that it's in Catholic Bibles between the Old and New Testaments. And you got a book called 2 Maccabees. Now, 1 and 2 Maccabees, 1 Maccabees is considered quite historical. So the Catholics include it in their Bibles. We don't, because we don't think it's divinely inspired, but it still gives us some significant historical information about that period. 2 Maccabees repeats a lot that's in First Maccabees, but addresses some things up and makes it a little more dramatic, and sometimes makes for a better story, but isn't necessarily as historically accurate as First Maccabees. But in Second Maccabees, it talks about seven Jewish sons who were brought before the Seleucid or Syrian king. So, and at that point, this king was Antiochus, I think it was the fourth. He was demanding that the Jews not circumcise their sons, that they give up their dietary laws and eat just like everyone else. Well, these sons, these seven Jewish sons, he got word that they weren't obeying him. And so he brings them up and he says, okay, I'm going to give you a chance here to live. I want you to kill this pig and fix yourself a pork meal. And so the oldest son says, well, I refuse to do that. And so the king threatens him and he says, I still refuse. And so he has skin peeled off the guy's head. And then when he still won't do it, he cuts his tongue out. And then when he still won't do it, he chops his hands and his feet off. And then when he still refuses to eat the meal, they heat up a very large pan until it's red hot, and they put him in it and fry him alive. And then they come to the, I told you this is disturbing stuff. Then they come to the second guy, the second oldest brother, and they say, all right, we will do to you like we did to your brother unless you fix this pork meal for yourself. And he says, well, I refuse. And so they do the same thing to him, and they do the same thing to the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth. And the seventh, they say, come on, you're the youngest. Be kind to your mom. Don't let make us put you through this as well. But he just really trash talks the king, and they give him even worse tortures. What's really interesting about the story is that you've got one of the brothers just before they take his hands and his tongue out. He sticks out his hands and his tongue at the king, and he says, you see these, king? I will receive these back at the resurrection on the last day. But for you, O king, there will be no resurrection. So he's trash-talking. He's taunting the king. And we find this kind of stuff in the literature. Now, no doubt this stuff is kind of, embellished. Because how is, sometimes, the guy's in the frying pan, he's talking like this to the king. And I'm thinking, a couple weeks ago, my wife was doing some ironing, and I just kind of brushed, she had laid the iron down, and I kind of brushed by it at one point, and I touched my finger against the hot iron, gave it a blister within a couple of minutes, and it's like, at that second, when I touched the iron, there's no way I'm going to be able to utter something coherent, Can you imagine being in a red-hot frying pan and trash-talking the person doing this to you? Especially after you'd had your tongue cut out? This stuff was embellished probably in order to give encouragement to readers who may be facing a similar situation in their near futures. But the whole point is, within this Jewish martyrdom literature, some of which came before Jesus, it was to, in you have these really bold Jewish martyrs. You also have it with Christian martyrs later on. Like I mentioned, the martyrdom of Polycarp, that's probably been embellished and dressed up. And the reason being is they take Polycarp and they go to nail him to the stake, and he says, "Oh, you don't have to do that. My love for the Lord will keep me here." And so they don't nail him to it. Yeah, right. The Romans are going to care that much about it. And then they light it on fire, but the fire does not consume Polycarp at all. It's like he's in the middle of it, just like the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So what happens? A Roman soldier takes a sword and he stabs Polycarp. And that kills him. But so much blood comes out of Polycarp that it extinguishes the fire. Thinking, all right, this has probably been dressed up a little bit too. Okay. So the thing is, though, Polycarp, he's so bold while he is being executed. And no doubt this happened on occasions, but you see this kind of things that are going on in the stories, and you're saying, but these Christians and especially the Jewish martyrs, they're so bold. It's like, racks and stones may break my bones, but resurrection awaits me. You know, it's now contrast that with Jesus. All right. And he's not like that so much. In fact, it's really interesting. Right before the Jewish martyrs die, they'll say something on many occasions like, God, I've not forsaken your law. They pray, God, I have not forsaken your law. But when we come to Jesus, he's in the garden and he wants out if possible. Father, if it's your will, let this cup pass from me. Probably not something that would have been too inspiring to his disciples, to whom recently he had said, if you want to be my disciple, you've got to be willing to take up your cross and follow me. And then when he's about ready to be arrested, to be crucified, he wants out if possible. And then while he's on the cross, he's not saying, God, I have not forsaken your law. He's saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? So what does this tell us? I think this tells us that whereas you've got the Jewish accounts and some later Christian accounts that have been dressed up a little bit, the Gospels give us more of a realistic picture of what it's like. They aren't dressing things up. They're giving us things more or less like they actually happened. They're giving us the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's pretty cool to see that. So we have good reason to think that Jesus was crucified. Now, what about insights? Let me just give you a few. And I see I'm working on against the clock now. So it gives us an example for living the Christian life. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul says, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. And he goes on to say, who, although he existed in the form or role of God, he did not regard equality, being equal with God, something to be held on to. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a human and being made in human appearance. And being found in human appearance, he subjected himself to the most bitter of deaths, even death on the cross. So the thing that Paul is saying here, he's given Jesus as an example when he says, do not merely look out for your own interest, but look out for the interest of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. He was existing in the role of God. He emptied himself of that role, came down to earth, and suffered the cruel death on the cross for us. For us. He was more interested in our interest than his own comfort at that point. And Paul is saying, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. There is no status, no one is of any status where they cannot and should not serve others. Understanding why the gospel was unattractive to many in the first century, that it really gives us insight into that. As Paul says, we preach Christ crucified, which is a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. You see, for the Gentiles, when you look at their stories of pagan gods, their gods were never crucified. Now, there was one case in the Homeric literature where Prometheus is crucified by Zeus for Pandora's box and showing fire to humans. So he's crucified and he's supposed to be up there for all eternity, nailed to this rock, but he is rescued. Gods cannot die. Gods do not remain on crosses, but Jesus was. So it would have been foolishness to or a stumbling block to Gentiles to think that a God was crucified and died. To Jews, remember, anyone who's hung on a cross is cursed by God. So this was foolishness to to Jews and a stumbling block. Jesus had to die finally. He had to die in order so that he could take God's curse upon himself so that we could have eternal life. And this gives insights. One final thing is you've got Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, where it says, Jesus, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising its shame. For what he saw dying on the cross would do for us. He loved us so much. It was the joy that was set before him. He joyfully did it for us. He despised, cared little, didn't care at all about the shame that it brought to him publicly, because he loved us that much. I think it's cool stuff. So I'll just close by saying that as sobering as this can be about what crucifixion and the tortures that preceded it and all that this meant in antiquity, that this was what happened on a Friday. But we need not stay in any kind of state of sadness because Sunday's on its way. All right, let's open this up. If you have questions for just a moment or two here, I can take two questions. Yes, sir. Yes.
But some of the skeptics say that John may have borrowed from the Bible earlier. So could you go a little deeper into that?
Yeah, so, yeah. So we say that Mark and John are independent of one another. But some skeptics will say that John borrowed from Mark. I would say that there aren't many who do that. Now, a lot of scholars who specialize in the gospel studies, they will say they're kind of split. Some will say John knew of Mark as a source, but he didn't use him. Others will say, well, John didn't even know of Mark as a source, and we really don't know. We do know that Matthew and Luke used Mark as a source, okay? So that's why when a lot of times they're reporting the same thing, we can't say that they're independent. All right, if the story, and a lot of times, like last year when I came in, we talked about the synoptic problem, the synoptic puzzle. It's times when there's like verbatim agreement between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Well, obviously, there's some sort of a dependence there, a literary dependence. But we don't find that ever between John and Mark. So we would certainly regard those at very minimum as being independent sources. One more?
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, you said that the hand was considered anywhere from here down.
Yes.
I was curious to what was the arm considered?
I don't know that they had a word for that. I'm trying to think. I don't remember memorizing any vocabulary card that had the word arm. So I don't know. That's a good question.
So the arm in the Bible, like when they say anything about the arm, you don't...
Well, that would be Hebrew, right?
The Hebrew.
Hebrew and Aramaic, not Greek. So there may be a word for arm, but I'm not aware of it.
I see.
It's a fair question, though. Yeah, maybe. Yep. Well, this is usually over a quarter after?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, one more?
All right, thank you. I'm Claude. I enjoyed your presentation today. I'm a third-generation Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, okay.
But... not anymore, okay?
Yeah. That's good, because we would have had to talk after class.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm 61 years old, and I'm starting over again. And so now, with all of the new things that I'm learning, sometimes I get angry, you know, because I thought I had the truth, and I didn't. Jerry Nuznev has been studying with me every Thursday. And it's amazing the things that I'm learning, and even just today with about Tao, with the tree, which is a tree, you know, it's just everything is just really just coming together. I'll put it that way. And I just want to thank you.
Well, thanks, brother. Okay. Appreciate it. And don't you feel bad? I mean, I think about Paul, where he was. Now he wasn't 61 when he converted, but. But he spent all that time climbing up the ladder as a very, very committed and zealous Jew and fighting against the church. But look at what God was able to do with him in just, you know, a few years that he was a believer. So don't feel bad. Yeah, it is exciting. And besides, you probably during those years you studied the Bible seriously and learned a lot, probably a lot that's true. And so there's just some things like – your Christology and some things that have just had to change. So glad you're in the kingdom, brother. God bless you guys. Let's close in prayer. And visit my website, risenjesus.com. You can find some things there. Lord, thank you so much for this time. I thank you for everyone in here. Bless them abundantly, Lord. Give us a great week. We ask in Christ's name. Amen.